Orphan Black season finale is over, but we are, of course, just getting started here on Post-Show Recaps. My name is Jessica Leese, and it's been a long, crazy season, and there's been one person who has been on this ride with me from the very beginning up until this bittersweet ending. Here he is, the one and only Mr. Mike Bloom.
Thank you so much, Jess. I'm glad we were able to ride in the metaphorical tow truck to pull this season along to the very end.
Yep. We cruised on in our motorized wheelchair.
Yep. I like that even better than the tow truck. I think I'm surprised that she's still, I guess she's gaining back her faculties one by one, but I'm still kind of surprised Rachel's in the wheelchair.
Yeah, especially the last time we saw Rachel, it seemed like she had made this miraculous recovery.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, she's gained more, you know, powers of speech. Obviously, she has a new body part that she can now admire in the mirror. But I also wonder if her new kidnappers are going to sort of help the wheelchair problem very quickly.
Yeah, I have a feeling they're not going to be chomping at the bit to get her back on her feet.
Oh, you don't think so?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say because I think she's easier to keep track of if she's not running around, you know?
I guess that's true. So is the eye like a taste, you know, when they say in drug dealing that you want to, you know, first taste is free and then you have to, it sort of brings people in. Is it their sort of a tactic to get Rachel to trust in the Neo-Illusionist?
Yeah, I think she's going to need to do a little quid pro quo. I think the rest she's going to have to earn that stuff.
Yeah, so this was the big, you know, we usually say in season finales in general, not just in Orphan Black, with the exception of maybe some, you know, big episode 9 heavy series like Game of Thrones or The Wire or anything like that. We usually say, okay, season finale, ready for big twists to happen. And I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was like the Neo-Illusionist slash the return of Mrs. Duncan. That was the big main twist of this episode, right?
Yeah, I think it got a little losty in there for a while where it was like, you know, the others are the Dharma Initiative and, you know, the eyeliner guy owning the pharmaceutical plant, that's also the Dharma Initiative, and except it's not, except it's this other company. And I feel like we were getting a little taste of that with, like, you know, Castor and Leda are the same parent company and Topside is owned by the Neo-Illusionists, and it's just like it's its own vocabulary and it's a little confusing.
Now, what was your reaction to seeing the Neo-Illusionists? Because we, for all intents and purposes, kind of wrote them off ever since Leaky died off in season 2. We assumed that he was the be all end all, the grand poobah of Neo-Illusionism, if you will. So it kind of died out with him. But we're to find out that, you know, as you said, not only are they alive and well, but they seem to be controlling all the major players in this season.
Yeah, that was a little bit shocking because I think we definitely did sort of feel like Dr. Leaky was the Neo-Illusionism movement, but we should have known better because there were enough people in on this thing that, you know, they all had that weird contact lens and they were all like growing tails and shit. And he had a big following. I guess that following wouldn't totally go away, and I guess someone's got to administrate that.
Now, how about instead of fixing Rachel's and getting her out of the wheelchair, they instead give Rachel like a mermaid tail. So that way, even if she's out of the chair, she won't be able to get out very easily.
Well, now you're starting to sound like that weird Kevin Smith movie that came out last year with the guy that turned the guy into a walrus.
I never heard of. Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Let's not talk about that one. I do not want and everyone at home, please do not Google images from that film, because the moment you see Justin Long sewn into a flesh walrus costume is the moment that you realize your life has changed for the worse.
Yeah, that's something you can't unsee. Like for those who don't know what we're talking about a year and a half ago, Kevin Smith was doing the Smodcast, which is his podcast, and he was, I would say he's about an 11 on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as high. And they start talking about this idea for a movie. And they just keep riffing off of one another. And it just snowballs until a point where he's like, I'm going to make this movie. And then he got the funding and made the movie. And it's pretty gross and pretty terrifying. So, yeah.
Yeah, and pretty terrible from what I hear. I'm not a horror movie fan, but I'm one of those weird masochistic people that likes to read synopsis for horror movies online. So when I read it, I was very confused and weirded out. And then I found out later on that apparently it was not a very well-received movie either. So I think he's making a follow-up to it that takes place in the same world but doesn't have anything to do with what happened. But Kevin Smith should probably stick to, you know, regular guys standing around talking about their girlfriends that have had sex with an inordinate amount of men instead of people in walrus costumes.
Yeah, I think I appreciate his desire to push the envelope and to kind of stretch his creative horizons, but this is one I'm probably going to skip, and I think most of the critics wish they could have skipped it as well.
Yeah, though this might be the neo-illusionist like Magnus Opum now. Who's to say? Maybe it's like the Illuminati. Maybe there's celebrities that are neo-illusionists as well.
Yeah, that could be. Or maybe it's like the Church of Scientology.
I think this is the segment now where I edit a postmortem that says Jessica Lise was never found again after Scientology on post-show recaps.
Yeah, well, we're going to need like Robert Stack to narrate that. But one thing I noticed that as soon as you said neo-illusionist, and I was thinking back about who was neo-illusionist back in the first season, and I realized that Rachel's new prosthetic eye, she looks like those neo-illusionists that had those weird contacts.
Yep, that's what I noticed as well. And I didn't pick it out at first because, again, it's all the way back in season one. And even though I binged it a couple months ago, it all kind of has become mush in my head a bit. So I didn't immediately recognize it at first. But as soon as the whole reveal happened, I thought, oh, of course, that is the sort of. And I don't know if it's necessarily if that means that all the neo-illusionists got the robotic eye that Rachel got or if it's just sort of a more cosmetic change. But yeah, that's one of those Easter eggs that you don't really pick up on until after the fact.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I think it's something. I think it's a very cosmetic thing. I feel like they're just like, oh, I'm going to brand myself as a neo-illusionist by getting this weird looking contact. But, you know, Rachel takes it a step further because Rachel goes 110% into everything she does.
Well, I mean, if the choice is you're going to have this weird cultish eye or you're not going to have any eye at all, give me the cultish eye.
Yeah, I guess so. And I thought that the place where she winds up waking up, which I guess is Austria, she wakes up in this really ornate bedroom and there's a bunch of runes on the mirror. Like, that was super losty, too. And I thought, oh, are we going to go there? But then I realized they're the same runes that are in the book. So.
Yeah, I was about to say, and I wondered if, like, the first thing that sprung to my head was that the runes were on the wall and that she would have to, like, figure them out, you know, whether this is sort of like a Saw type of thing. her captors were trying to torture her. But, yeah, and again, that's one of those little breadcrumb Easter eggs that you don't even think about until it's realized that Susan Duncan is one of her captors that you realize, oh, yeah, that would make sense because she's the one that it's apparently it wasn't just Ethan Duncan who created that code. I'm assuming his wife did, too.
Yeah, well, they were partners, and then there was some sort of schism. But we were never, correct me if I'm wrong, we were never told that anything did or did not happen to Susan Duncan before. I think we were led to believe she was dead.
Yes, from what I remember, the show luckily keyed us in on us on this a little bit in the beginning of the episode when Rachel had that dream sequence. It repeated Ethan's words in the season two finale where he talked about he quote unquote figured out that Leaky had poisoned Susan Duncan and he thinks that she died, which sort of leads to his own self-poisoning as well. But I guess that wasn't true. And then this opens up a bunch of other questions as to was Ethan lying or how did, you know, I guess the question of how Susan Duncan was able to fake her death isn't that bad because Ethan Duncan was able to fake his own death only to be found out later on. So it only makes sense that Susan would be. I want a flashback episode for Susan just to see, you know, in the 1970s or whenever this schism happened, what happened after that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of, I feel like they answered some questions and then they just like made sure they dropped an equal number of new questions on us.
So do you think though, and this might be again me putting on my tinfoil hat here, do you think that the producers bringing up the neo-illusionists again was sort of a meta moment in terms of them saying, okay, we're done with the casters. We're done with suggesting bringing in new forces for them to combat. We're going to go back to what it was like in season one.
I think it could very well be kind of hitting the reset button because we did go a little off the rails this season.
Yeah.
Like, this was certainly the weirdest of the three seasons, and it felt a lot of times like they were introducing twists for the sake of twists.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, if we're taking a step backward, I'm totally fine with it.
Yeah, I'm totally fine too, and I hope this means that season four is a more back to basic season. I was sort of thinking about this as the episode went, and I'm sure we'll talk about our general thoughts of episode three later on. And I thought it finished pretty well, all things considered, but I agree with you. I think it was definitely a season where things were kind of thrown at the wall a bit writing wise. And I think if they're able to look at themselves and say, let's go back to what is a winning formula that made the show succeed in the first place, I think that's where a successful season four is going to be, not going, say, the Lost route and making things a little more complicated and a little more tangled up.
Yeah. But, you know, to Lost's credit, they did kind of the same thing. Like, season one was fantastic. Season two, they kind of went in a different direction and it got weirder. And then they thought, well, that's no good. That people aren't really responding to these new characters and these new twists. Let's dial it back. They dialed it back for seasons three and four. Season three and four were great. They got weird again. It got worse. Yeah. So I think maybe I would guess Orphan Black is going to take a lot of cues from Lost and maybe not repeat some of the same mistakes.
Well, they also have this reduced episode count, and I think that was another thing that worked in Lost's favor, is that after the writer's strike, they started reducing their seasons, and so this made them say, okay, we don't need any more Jack Tattoo flashback episodes. We don't have a 22-episode or 26-episode season that we're stretching to. Now we really need to pack things in, and having it be a 10-episode season, and we've already seen it with Game of Thrones. Granted, that has way more plot lines than this does, but you're able to really condense the action. And I will say, in spite of everything that went on in season three, I don't think there are too many moments that we felt that this was fluff. I felt that everything did have its purpose at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. And they definitely, this show is very good at setting things up so that you come back to them and you realize, oh, that's why they did that. That's why that was there.
Yeah. Speaking of which, do we want to talk some Ferdinand here?
Yeah, Ferdinand. And I love that we never found out that dude's name. It's just like Ferdinand and Lurch.
Yeah, and Lurch, you're right to point out Lurch last week, because Lurch was the, I guess, Chekhov's henchman. In terms of he was one of the Neo-Illusionists.
Yeah, I guess you got to assume everybody's a Neo-Illusionist until you can prove otherwise.
Yeah, Ferdinand in this episode definitely gained many, many points in my book. I previously thought of him as just kind of a creep, but now I realize that, like, he's kind of a badass creep in the way that he doesn't have personality changes, but he's able to use those traits to kind of inform his character, which is sort of this ultra smart, almost like if 007 was a bigger perv than he is.
That's hard to do.
It's hard to, or at least less of a womanizer, more of a fetish guy. Just because, I mean, you got to look back in his lines and, you know, all his stuff to Delphine about how he likes being under the boot of a woman, but now he's ready to have her under his boot. And I love that conversation that he has with Sarah when he realizes that she was the one impersonating Rachel. And it's not, you know, Sarah doesn't flat out say, there are a lot of confessions on the show where people reveal the truth to each other, but this wasn't like Sarah saying, you know, I was impersonating Rachel. She just quoted something that he said. And I love the way that was written. And of course, when he just goes after Lurch, and it was, that's when I guess we got to see the badass part of him slash the very sadistic part of him, because he butchered that guy and was going to, presumably off camera. But I wonder if he's going to become a bigger part of season three now, sort of like what happened with Mark and Gracie, or season four.
Yeah, it sure seems like every season we get one bad guy that everybody's fighting against, and then in the following season that person has been turned around to be on their side, either because they're actually good, because they turned good, or because they're just necessary.
Yeah, though I think in this case we've lost like four characters and gained him, so it's a little imbalanced.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that trade. It doesn't seem particularly fair to me.
Yeah, though I guess we have to talk about that as well. And I feel like Orphan Black sort of went the gratuitous character death route this season, in terms of first Paul is dead, Delphine is presumably dead at the end of this episode. I can only assume, though at this show, dead is definitely not dead.
Yeah.
So for all we know, she could be put on life support somewhere. But Dr. Nealon, who wasn't in too many episodes but was still kind of a presence, is most definitely dead and had some sort of weird worm in his mouth, which is probably the freakiest moment of the episode.
Yeah, he went full Wrath of Khan with that thing.
What was it supposed to? Was it supposed to be like a brain worm or something? Was it supposed to subdue her?
I don't know if it was like, maybe it was toxic and he was going to like cough it up and have it kill her, but that seems like kind of a tiny thing to kill someone.
Yeah, I mean, I think, or maybe Dr. Neeling just had too much tequila and had the worm at the bottom in his mouth.
Oh, never eat the worm. Yeah, Dr. Neeling.
Let's also bring up the fact that Dr. Neeling is not a good sense of judgment, too. And we definitely called this when the whole Rachel Crystal switch happened. If Delphine's in a room alone and is checking on her, she's going to find something out about it, because he did not ensure any sort of measures or think about any things that could go wrong. And everything that could go wrong did go wrong.
Yeah. You know, maybe take the fancy manicure off the nail tech before you have her impersonating another clone.
Yeah, or take out her eye. Or, you know, if you say she's in a coma, put her in a freaking coma.
Yeah, I thought that she might be in some kind of really terrible coma. The last time we saw Crystal, she was fast asleep and she was not looking good. And I was worried they were going to maybe, you know, keep her in some kind of deep medical coma that could potentially have brain problems later on. Or, you know, just outright kill her after, even though Rachel said don't. You know, Rachel's gone. What's Rachel going to do?
So. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. And I think the best measures would have been for him to like give her a lobotomy. So even if she did wake up, you could say, oh, Rachel, you're slurring your speech again. I'm glad to have you back, but too bad you can't say anything about what's happened to you.
Yeah. Are there so many sedatives that they could give her?
Yeah. This guy clearly is just either very lazy or not very good at being a bad guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely, I don't know what his deal is. Like, maybe he wanted it to explode in some way, but really he had a lot of loose ends he didn't tie up, and that's why he ends up dying.
Yeah, and I thought for a second, you know, when he had that smile on his face when Delphine entered the cell, it reminded me a lot of the Joker in The Dark Knight, when it turns out that he did want to get arrested, and that's when, you know, had the cell phone in the stomach that blew everything up. So I was wondering if this was part of some sort of, like, larger organization, but no, again, no plan. He just shows Delphine that, you know, they're holding Rachel. He admits to everything and then tries to spit a worm into her mouth and dies doing so.
You know, that is straight out of James Bond. You know, I'm going to tell you every detail of my plan, and then I'm going to find some convoluted way to kill you. And it's probably not going to work.
Yeah. But this brings up a question, though. With Neeling and Delphine dead, I mean, the corporate ladder of Dyad is so tenuous to begin with. But with, like, the two most important people dead, what's going to happen?
I would guess that if you're in the biotechnology sector, you might want to brush up your resume and start looking on, you know, monster.com, because I'm guessing there's quite a few openings.
I think it's going to be Scott.
Yeah. Scott seems to be, like, he's had a lot of responsibility this season, and he's been really vocal. Like, he is suddenly in the core group. He's honorary clone club now. Before, he was just, like, kind of, you know, he was kind of on the outs with everybody. He knew what was going on, but he didn't. And now I think he is an honorary brother Sestra, just like Felix.
Yeah, he was at dinner.
Yeah. He got to go to the Clone Club dinner party, which was a little more subdued than the Clone Club dance party, but still an opportunity to show off those wonderful special effects.
Yeah, which did you like more at the end of the day, Clone Club dinner party or dance party?
Dance party seemed to be a little more fun and a little more, like, I guess a little more exuberant. Clone Club dinner party was more domestic, although I liked that it so neatly bookended the season after we started out with Helena's weird fever dream where they're all together having a meal.
Yeah, I will say, I think season two was fun because there are very few, like, nonverbal pivotal scenes that happen on television nowadays. I feel like everything is so script heavy that they don't rely too much on, you know, looks and general feeling. So I think the dance party was a nice, like, you know, a needle in a haystack of things you rarely find on TV. I did like the dinner scene, that it flashed between all these different pairings of people. Like, you know, you have Helena and Donnie talking, and then you have Cosima and Scott spouting off chimera analogies to each other, and you have Sarah and Art talking. So, like, I was happy about that. And I do agree, it was a nice bookend as well. I also question maybe the choice to have the dinner in the bubble store, because with all the stuff they make in there, that has to be an overwhelming odor that would completely block out the taste and smell of any of that food.
Yeah, I would not want to eat a meal in a Lush.
Not even the vodka cake?
Yeah, not even that. Is this like a cake with meat in it? I mean, I live in New York City. I know what a babka is, but...
Can you? I mean, I live in New York too, but I haven't had so much Ukrainian food. Can you enlighten me and the audience as to what babka is?
Well, babka is, that's Jewish food too. Like, you can get it in any kosher bakery in the city. It's a kind of a flaky cake with like a chocolate swirl in it.
So how much do you think Helena's babka measures up to a New York babka?
I would guess that homemade is always better.
Even if Helena makes it?
Well, Helena might slip some extra ingredients in there.
Or a knife.
Or a knife, yeah. If Helena brings me one in prison, I will be excited, but, you know, maybe I would go to Hot and Crusty if I was not.
Yeah, I'd probably order a pizza if she offered me some babka cake.
Yeah, but I don't know, man. You got to try it. It's pretty delicious.
All right, that'll be my goal in the 9-month off season of Orphan Black.
Yeah, any kind of remotely Jewish bakery, just go in and order a chocolate babka. They know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, but we live in New York. All bakeries are pretty much remotely Jewish at this point.
Yeah, except the ones that are Mexican and Korean.
Yeah, exactly.
But even then, they know what you're talking about because yeah, very true. New York. Yeah, so how surprised were you that Jesse Toewing is back in Helena's life?
That was fun, and I was very surprised until we got that, the final closer look of the season, which is basically just Tatiana Maslany saying, like, we work with a lot of fun guest stars, so it was nice to bring people back. And it makes me realize, like, oh, Orphan Black kind of is that show that it's going to, if you're a guest star for one episode, you're probably going to make an appearance at some point down the line. We even saw that with her body double when she played that random Prolethean girl earlier on in the season.
Yeah.
So I was thrilled about it. It was also nice just because, you know, Helena has had seems like she has a somewhat happy ending right now. I mean, she has her boyfriend back. They're starting to round the bases towards home plate. She has a great family life. She's friends with Donnie. She got to brutally murder people and satisfy her bloodlust. So really, I would call Helena the winner right now.
Yeah, Helena, I think, is the winner of the season. Although the thing that surprised me is, you know, this is based on one hookup in a bar from last season. And I was kind of shocked. Like, I could see Helena being a little bit naive about relationships. And I could totally see her, like, doing the Rain Man thing where she makes out with one person in a bar and then thinks they're in a relationship after that. But I was very pleasantly surprised by, A, I totally forgot how hot that guy is, and B, he was totally as into her and he hasn't stopped thinking about her either. So that was cute. And, you know, put on the REO Speedwagon, get a little busy. I'm down.
Yeah, is his hotness mitigated by the fact that he wears a trucker hat?
You know, he's pulling it off. And I think he is actually kind of a trucker. So I think if you are kind of a trucker, you're allowed to wear the trucker hat.
Yeah, I really like it. And it is a little odd. And it's one of those things where I think if it was out in the real world, which is weird to say because this is a science fiction drama all about cloning. But if this did take place in the real world, I do unfortunately feel like someone like Jesse would not be up. He seems like a really nice guy, maybe a little atypical for the trucker type. But I feel like a typical trucker would sort of, you know, be like one and done and sort of swear off this girl forever. So I do love that, like, all of Helena's weird quirks actually endears herself to Jesse. It's something that I definitely did not expect when I came into this series.
I guess there's a lid for every pot.
That's very true. Every you know, I'm of the belief that everyone has some sort of soulmate out there somewhere, and I'm glad that Helena was able to find hers.
Yeah, I hope that we see more of Jesse Toewing in the future, and I hope that we just call him that. I don't need to know his last name.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too. Obviously, Ferdinand, I think, has a much more open door here in terms of he knows everything that's going on, so he can be brought in as an ally. Will Jesse be brought into Clone Club eventually? Or, like, he has no reason to leave right now, now that she's found him again.
Yeah, he's going to have to be brought in. Well, he has, correct me if I'm wrong, he has met Sarah.
Yes, he has, because they were the ones that... I think they were trying to find Duncan. Yes, Sarah went into the church to find out information about Duncan, and that's when Helena was in the bar with Jesse.
Yeah, Helena was in the bar ordering like the 5 different looking drinks, and then she meets Jesse, and Sarah comes and gets her.
Yep, exactly. From jail.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to say he at least knows she's a twin, and I think he's not fazed by she's got science babies inside her, and she's got an insatiable bloodlust. He's down with pretty much everything, so I think she can probably bring him in.
Speaking of insatiable bloodlust, I totally forgot to mention another character that we got rid of this episode was Rudy.
Yeah, well, that was expected. He was a ticking time bomb.
Yeah, but for all intents and purposes, it feels like the Caster thing is pretty much dead at this point, right? It died out with Rudy, and Virginia was presumably taken away somewhere that Ferdinand led her to go.
Yeah, it seems like we've eradicated Caster, more or less.
Which is a thumbs up in my book. Not to say I didn't enjoy Ari Millen's performance, and I definitely enjoyed some of the Caster stuff as we sort of wound down to it kind of being just sort of Rudy and Mark, and we got more defined characteristics out of them. But like I talked about in the beginning, I feel like this was a little bit of like a jumbled type of thing that they happened to throw in there amidst all the other stuff that was going on. So if they decided to pull a mulligan and say like, okay, maybe we won't deal with this anymore, I'm totally fine with that.
Yeah. And you know, he was a clone. We've allowed for the possibility there might be additional clones. So I'm going to say that Ari Millen's probably going to be back in some capacity, maybe as Mark, maybe not.
Yeah, that's another open end, too. I mean, we know that Mark and Gracie, all they want to do is live their own life, which kind of brings up the question, if you're trying to live your own life, why do you always stay in this town? Considering that Sarah and Felix are pretty easily to hunt you down. You could very much just get in a car and just drive cross country. You have a very large country you live in. You can find a place in some other province. But I mean, I don't think this is the last we're going to see of Mark. I feel like Mark is going to keep getting pulled into all of this just because of what he knows.
Yeah, I think once you are inducted into the Clone Club, you can't really exit the Clone Club.
Yeah, very true. Going back to Rudy, I feel like for me, his fight with Helena was probably the highlight of the episode. And I think specifically their final conversation as he's laying there with his last dying breaths, because I mean, we talk about badass moments here, you know, him trying to tell her, oh, we're basically the same. We grew up the same together. And then Helena just brushing his hair past his face and says, no, you are a rapist, as he dies. It was,
yeah,
it's an amazing thing that harkens back to what we saw from Rudy at the very beginning, which is, you know, in spite of being a very loyal son, he has done all these horrible things with all the women that he's taken and had sex with and infected with this disease. So it's always nice to just like, I love that. And a show that gives a lot of sympathy to its villains, sometimes Helena did not let him have that satisfaction.
Yeah. And even so, she didn't let him have the satisfaction, but she still stayed with him until he died. And I thought that was kind of weirdly touching. Like they had the sort of brother sister moment where they're talking about their weird messed up childhoods and maybe bonding a little bit over that.
Yeah, and I think this also shows a change to Helena, too, because I think Helena in the first like season and a half was still kind of programmed as this religious assassin who doesn't consider the people she's killing as people, but instead just sort of targets that are preventing, you know, the great order to occur in her world. So now that she's starting to consider them as people, you know, I don't think season one Helena would have sat with Rudy and talked to him as he died. I think she would have just left him in that garage, which makes for two people that have now died in the Hendrix garage.
Yeah. If I ever visit the Hendrixes, I'm not going in the garage.
Well, and now are we just going to see another lump under the floor in the next season?
Well, now we've got a vat of sulfuric acid, so we could probably just kind of move him into that.
Yeah, I'm surprised that it wasn't brought up before. And I know we brought it up. We brought up the fantastic, iconic Jesse scene in the third episode of Breaking Bad. But I'm surprised that they didn't think of that to begin with when they're like, okay, we need to get rid of Dr. Leakey. Oh, let's bury him under the garage and completely redo our garage.
Yeah, I mean, Breaking Bad is not an unfamiliar series to Donnie and Els.
We would assume so, though. I did read an interview with the AV Club with the creator of Orphan Black after the finale, and they did say that they wanted to frame Allison's story closer to Weeds than Breaking Bad.
Yeah, I guess. Well, that, you know, that's cool, but be that as it may, I thought the parallels to Breaking Bad were way more fun.
Yeah, I completely agree, but it seems like, and I'm hoping not to jinx this, but it seems like we are completely, as we predicted, out of the woods on the drug running story.
Yeah, you know, maybe they'll just make soap. Like, that could be a perfectly lucrative business opportunity for them. They own the store now. They made enough money off the pills to, like, get themselves a little bit out of debt and get the store, and now they can sell soap. And that's, you know, good, clean fun, right?
Yeah, and I'm literally, and I'm just happy about it because I hope that this really brings Allison back into the fold. Because I think one of the main complaints of this season, both from us and a lot of people online, was that they felt like in spite of the Allison based episode we had a few weeks ago, Allison has been so separate from everything that's going on. And we understand comic relief, but to have to take away that core dynamic that we had so much fun with the past two seasons is not very good. So I hope that the whole Allison is the parents council treasurer or whatever it is, school board treasurer. The fact that that's a thing now is hopefully just sort of mentioned offhandedly. It reminds me a lot of in Glee, Kurt's father, played by Michael Malley, who actually was like one of the best actors on that show, surprisingly. He like won a seat on Congress and then they just decided not to talk about it except for a few rare occasions for the rest of the series. So I'm hoping it becomes something like that, so we don't say, all right, now next season Allison gets involved in the riveting world of school board meetings.
Yeah, it's like on Switched at Birth, they spent a season talking about the goings on in the Kansas State Legislature, and after they realized how god-awful boring that is, they basically almost never mentioned that the guy is in the state assembly or state senate, I can't remember which, but they never mentioned it again.
Yeah. And I you also have to acknowledge, if we're sort of wrapping up Allison's story here, I love her, not only her speech at the end, but her acknowledgement of Donnie, just because even looking at both this season's arc and also the arc from like the very first season when she truly believes she found out she's correct later that he is a monitor, to have that sort of level of distrust evolve into this whole thing where, you know, he's defending, he, you know, tries to fight Jason Kellerman for her, and he ends up getting his refund and, you know, ends up on no part of his own having Helena mass murder everybody and sort of resolve that problem. I think she's found a lot of trust in Donnie, and it makes me really excited to see like what their dynamic will be, because I do think, as funny as it was, I feel like the first few episodes of this season was very much like, it's all sort of like of Mice and Men in terms of like you have like the smaller, smarter, more wily one and then the big dumb guy. So I'm happy that that relationship has resolved itself a little bit.
Yeah. And I think Donnie also had a lot of character development this season, where we not only found a lot about his backstory, but he learned a lot about himself and he was able to grow. I think maybe he might be the most changed at the end of this season.
Yeah, I would say so. And I mean that also, aside from all the characters that died, of course, because you could say they went from living to dead over the course of the season. And I would say that even from a writer standpoint, they would say, oh, we gave Donnie his own storyline and that works. And that makes me excited, because I do feel like maybe one of the things that Orphan Black kind of uses as a crutch is that Tatiana Maslany is basically in almost every scene. So I'm happy that in a little bit in this season, and hopefully more next season, we got more scenes with just the supporting characters, because they have rich tapestries as well. So I would love to see more Donnie interacting with other people.
Yeah. And at this point, you know, like we said before, we have a lot of honorary clones now. And I think Donnie is absolutely an honorary clone, just the same as like Felix and Art and Scott. And I think these guys can carry scenes. All of these actors are tremendously talented and can carry a scene. Maybe not quite as well as Tatiana can, but definitely they can hold their own.
Yeah. Speaking of Art, we saw Art.
Yay. We didn't forget about Art.
Yeah. What was he? Was he just hanging out in the police station until Sarah finally gave him a call and said, hey, I need you to find a safe house for the original man/woman clone?
I think Art probably has plenty on his plate. I mean, Toronto's a big city, lots of crime. So
yeah, that's true. We need to remember that there are actual crimes that need to be solved that don't directly involve the clones.
Yeah, you know, Art is busy. Like, he has a whole segment of his life that we really know nothing about, and we could do a whole, like, Law and Order special Canadian unit, and it stars, like, Art and Angela, and they solve crimes. And nobody watches it.
Now, I think we talked about this at the very beginning of our seasons 1 and 2 recap, but man, I am happy that Angie was not brought back onto this show.
Yeah, we've done just fine without Angie.
Yeah, no Angie, no Vic, no. But unfortunately, I keep forgetting this topside woman's name that you keep bringing up.
Marion Bowles, played by the wonderful Michelle Forbes.
Yeah, no Marion Bowles, which is interesting considering that we saw her daughter this episode. So I'm wondering if she ever comes back to the show, what sort of role she plays.
I think it's pretty clear by the fact that her her daughter is now going to be adopted by Rachel, and we didn't see her at all this season, I think it's pretty clear that Michelle Forbes is probably not coming back to the show in any capacity.
Yeah, which is unfortunate, because I love that little season two thing, and I feel like had she stayed onto the show, she was going to be a great envoy to kind of help explain things, and maybe she would be also involved in this very twisted corporate ladder of everything. But nope, she's gone. I guess Rachel's going to raise her now, but I guess that's another, again, maybe that's just some more faulty logic on the Neo-Lucianist part. Like, oh, we need someone to raise her. Let's give her to the woman in the wheelchair who is just starting to remember how to speak again.
Yeah, well, she did always want a child.
Yep, that's very true. Now you have one.
And again, there's another TV spinoff I would watch. Like, a plucky clone making it out in the world for the first time on her own and raising her own clone.
I feel like since they're in Austria, it's like a weird take on The Sound of Music.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like, there's culture shock involved and, there's singing and clothing made out of curtains. And it's just like her and her clone.
Does that mean that Rachel will fall in love with Sarah Duncan? They'll all sing Edelweiss to escape the Prolethians.
Yeah, I could certainly see, like, Ferdinand coming back and portraying the Captain Von Trapp.
Oh my god, I want this. I want the Orphan Black cast to now be cast in The Sound of Music.
Well, and I'm going to call it now. Helena is the smallest child that sings on the Goodnight song.
Oh, Gretel?
Yeah. The sun has gone to bed.
Yes, she'll probably, yes, and she has to sing it, the way she usually sings in her monotone voice. I think
the sun has gone to bed and so must I.
I think this absolutely needs to happen. But Rachel and Ferdinand, from what we can tell, the given circumstances of the way Ferdinand treated quote-unquote Rachel beforehand, you have to assume they do have some sort of weird, twisted relationship.
Yeah, yeah, again, there's a lid for every pot. Maybe they're destined to be together. Like, once Ferdinand finds her and, they sort some things out, she makes a little bit more of a recovery, maybe they can find what they lost.
Do you think that next season is going to be a Rachel rescue mission?
I think next season we're going to see Rachel come back in some form. Like, I don't know if she needs to be rescued or if she's going to be someone that, provokes someone else's need to be rescued. Like, yeah. She may be on the back burner right now while she, figures out her spine, but she could definitely come back again as a villain.
Yeah, we need to kind of analyze here where things are, because I think going into this episode, the Clone Club had so many threats going against them. They had sort of a huge Hydra-like creature of, you had a little bit of Topside with Ferdinand, and you obviously had Castor, and you also had a little bit of Dyad as well, and they thought Rachel was coming after them too. So they were able to eliminate a lot of their threats, but at the same time, it seems like the Neo-Lucianists are coming after them. From what the way Delphine acted in front of Cosima, she knew that the people were coming after her. And you can hide Kendall Malone in Iceland if you want, but I feel like the new Neo-Lucianists are going to get information out of someone sooner or later.
Yeah, there's too many people that know about this now.
Yeah, exactly. It's the double-edged sword of letting people into Clone Club.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to keep a lid on secrets the more people that know them.
Yeah.
Like, who do you think is the weakest link there, though? Like, who would you go after if you needed to get those secrets?
Well, I think Art would be, just because you'd say, well, Beth would have told the secret to me.
Yeah, Art, we know his weak spots.
Yes, Art has a very prominent weak spot. Initially, I would have said Scott, but Scott, again, as you said before, has kind of proved his resilience a bit this season and his loyalty. So he might be able to, I think he'd stay mum. I'd say everyone else. I think Felix and Mrs. S and everyone else are so loyal to each other. Mrs. S, maybe I put her second most likely, just because, she was the one that ended up selling Helena to Castor to presumably to keep the rest of her family safe. So if she feels like she's brokering a deal to save her family, her immediate family, she may sell someone out.
Yeah, that's true. We know that she also has a weakness that we can exploit.
Yeah, though, do we think she's a changed woman here? We saw one scene between her and Kendall Malone, and then they seem fine afterwards. Do we think this has some sort of effect on her character?
She seems like someone who would hold a grudge, but I think I have a hard time believing that just that one little touching conversation is going to tie up every loose end in their very complicated relationship, because once again, Kendall killed Mr. S.
Yeah, and I mean, I get that she, her action when she heard about Sarah, to send her to her daughter to kind of comfort her, that was a nice move. But as Kendall brought up herself, she lived a very foul life. You know, you can't really wash your hands of this situation, considering the fact that, again, she killed your husband.
Yeah, and she didn't even, like, accidentally kill him. It was very much on purpose.
I wonder, though, maybe Mrs. S is being a sadist a little bit in terms of, she says, like, well, I'm just going to send you to Iceland where you're going to freeze your ass off.
No, oh, Iceland is very beautiful, Mike. I'm sure that we'll be fine. And, you know, they got, you know, in my favorite secret Canadian moment of the week, everybody's got matching giant Canada Goose parkas. And you know those things are not cheap.
Yeah. I also loved how apparently they all know how to drive snowmobiles.
Yeah, snowmobiles are not hard. If you've driven an all-terrain vehicle, you could drive a snowmobile.
Well, the dark part of me wanted, when Kira was, like, you know, smiling and running in the snow, part of me wanted a Neo-Illusionist to just pull up. As much as we hate the kidnap Kira storylines, for them to just pull up and take her.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think after a certain point, there's only so many kidnappings you can do before they're just going to kill her.
So. Yeah, that's very true. Did you like the end of this episode?
Yeah, I thought it was a little bit pat, but I was okay with it, and I think it's nice we got a little trip to Iceland, and we got this multi-generational family reunion, sort of, I don't even know what anybody is to anybody anymore, because you would think it's like great-grandmother, grandmother, mother-daughter, but really it's like, you know, clone parent, adoptive parent, child, grandchild, we've got, you know, sister, we got three sisters, and a niece. There's so many weird things. Like, this is practically a new installment of I'm My Own Grandpa.
Yeah. Oh my god, yes. Referencing the Stupids.
Of course.
Oh god, best Tom Arnold movie ever, and that's not saying much.
Yeah, well, that song's even older than that.
Yeah, I remember, I think I learned it personally, though, from watching the movie The Stupids.
Yeah. Everybody mark it. This is the date and time Mike Bloom admits he saw The Stupids.
Oh, how could you not? It was a classic. More of a classic than Carpool, the other Tom Arnold movie I remember.
Did you see either one of those in the theater?
No. Those were one of those things that would pop up on HBO occasionally that I would watch.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I did not actively tug on my mother's skirt and say, let's go see The Stupids today in the cinema.
Yeah, okay, good.
But yeah, I think that, I mean, this also, again, is going to be a thing of, like, so are we just going to build this sort of safe house in Iceland where we send the characters that we don't really talk about anymore? I mean, I think those of us that are Game of Thrones fans know why Cal was not in the scene. and we can assume that he's just sort of around. But I'm wondering, you know, if they're trying to stay underground and stay away from the Neo-Illusionists, are they even going to bring up Iceland anymore?
Yeah, who even knows? Like, it could just be sort of like they have a beach house in Iceland and they just send people there when they need to not deal with them for a while. It's better than sending them to Belize.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Belize is at least warmer than Iceland is.
Yeah, I suppose. But I think it's a convenient place to put somebody when they need to go into timeout.
Yeah, that's very true. So, and we'll see, you know, Orphan Black, as I talked about before, is a show that if you introduce a character one time or a few times, they may come back to more prominence later on. We may see Cal and Kira come back into the scene, but I think that, I will say, I do agree with you that it was a little schmaltzy for it to be the last scene of the episode, but it is nice to remember that, like, Sarah is a mother and that the very reason why she decide to you know, masquerade as Beth and get herself involved in this whole situation to begin with was to support her daughter. So I was, you know, it was a nice little harkening back to literally the heart of the show.
Yeah, that is true. And I could also see, like, I think one of the reasons we're not seeing Kira anymore is, again, not to tie it back to Game of Thrones again, but we're running into the Isaac Hempstead Wright problem where not very much time has passed in the Orphan Black universe. Like, this has maybe been, like, 6 months total. But we have filmed this over the course of 3 years. And we have a child who's supposed to stay 7 years old. And, you know, by the time we start shooting next year, she's going to be 10.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's I don't think it's as outright of a problem as a boy going through puberty, just because with boys, their voices, you know, audibly change and they shoot up a foot. But girls do go through puberty earlier than boys do. So if this young actress just goes through puberty in before filming starts for season four, we could have a bit of a problem, unless she just does all of her scenes on her knees.
Yeah. Yeah. And she could be awkward. We don't know what she's going to look like when she gets older.
That's very true. We could have another like Ginny Weasley type of thing.
Yeah. You know, some of them are Emma Watsons and some of them are Rupert Grint.
Yeah. Yeah.
we never know which way that's going to go. So I could see there being a lot less of Kira in the coming seasons.
I could as well. And I mean, it's weird because I don't want to hate on the storyline too much, but I mean, we didn't have her for like 7 episodes of this season, and I kind of didn't have a problem with it personally.
Yeah, I kind of didn't miss her. I mean, I get that this is like one of Sarah's driving motivations, but you know, when you bring a kid on, it's a totally different dynamic.
Yeah, and plus, I think it's also it was belabored a little bit by the fact that we had seen the kidnap Kira thing so many times that I think when we saw her get out of the picture, we got some nice time away from that storyline.
Yeah, and there's really when you've got a 7-year-old kid in a show that's got very adult themes, that's about all you can do with her, and it gets really old. Yes, so unless they can come up with something brand new and inventive that they can do with the character, we're fine not to have her back.
Yeah, until we see Kira performing her own stunts and start, you know, wielding machine guns, I think we can keep her in Iceland.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe she can take some karate lessons from her Aunt Helena.
Yeah, or maybe she can learn how to be a hacker like Cal.
Wow. You know, I will be watching that spinoff in 15 years when, you know, 22-year-old Kira Manning is now, like, fighting crime with her, you know, elite computer hacking skills and martial arts skills and bow hunting skills. You know, that's a show I'll watch, but until then, we don't need to see the genesis of it.
Can Kira be the one to take the motor out of the Prolethean's car in the Abbey to stop as the clones escape into the mountains?
Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect.
She's not the, like, she's not the impish cute one, because that's Helena, but she can be, you know, one of the middle ones.
that would not make sense whatsoever, but okay.
Look, we're casting for personality, not for age.
That's true. We're being very theatrical in terms of we're defying any sort of casting types.
Yeah, you know, Allison is totally the Liesel of the group.
Yes, very true. The one. Well, yeah, I guess that's true. Does that make, will Donnie be Rolf?
Yeah, except, you know, not a Nazi.
No, but he'll still wear like the ridiculous short shorts like that guy in Sound of Music Live did.
Oh, you know it.
Absolutely. I mean, you gotta bring in ratings in some sort of way. Why not have some schlub shorts? Schlub shorts. Wow, that is a tongue twister.
Say that 5 times fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess we got to talk a little bit about Cosima and the lesbian drama, because we got to be there. But do you think that we're going to see Shay come back, or is Shay totally done with this?
I think Shay is back, but I also wonder if it's going to be the same thing as Jesse in terms of she's going to be very much on the peripherals, barely seen, because like Jesse, she hasn't been brought into anything with the Clone Club. But her military history has been revealed, and it was kind of a dud. It seemed like she was just like a massage therapist for the army. And that was basically, that's what she said. She was an RMT, and I from what I could find, RMT means registered massage therapist, unless I'm totally being a doof here and missed a military term.
Maybe it's because it's Canada. She's like part of the Royal Mounted Therapists.
they still wear the big hats, though.
Yeah. Yeah. She wears the hat and the red jacket, and then she massages people.
That'd be nice. I would want to be pulled over by a Mountie if they offered that service.
Yeah. Get some Mountie-sage.
I love it. That's our hashtag right there.
Yeah, that is our hashtag.
I've definitely admitted in the past that I'm not a big fan of both Shay and the storyline. That being said, as much as I didn't want to see Delphine die, I am happy that in a way with her death, the lesbian drama has died, because when we saw Cosima this episode in her scene with Kendall Malone and she showed to be this very confident, calming persona, I was like, okay, this is the Cosima we want to see. We don't necessarily need to see her involved in this love triangle or, you know, make threats with razor blades or anything like that. We did not see a good side of Cosima this season.
No.
And so, again, if we're going back to this whole back to basics season four, I really hope we honestly keep Cosima in the science.
Yeah. And what I would like to see, you know, maybe everybody's got a significant other, but every single one of those significant others except Donnie can all just kind of be mainly off screen. Like, they can allude to them like, oh, yeah, Elena can tell everybody, I've got to go out tonight. I can't have Clone Club meeting. Jesse and I are going to go see the new Jurassic Park movie. We'll see you later. And, you know, that's all we need. Or Sarah could be like, oh, I was on the phone with Cal today and he was saying blah, 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 blah. And Kira says hello to everybody.
Yeah, the only thing that I think we might fall into if we go into that trap is that we might rehash these storylines again of like, how will Cosima keep her secrets from Shay, which was basically all of season one. So if in going back to basics, if you're returning back to that again, that might be a rehash I might not be a big fan of.
Yeah, I suppose. There's only so much you can do with that, too.
Yeah, exactly. Because again, we've already been through it before. If we just replace characters with other characters, though we haven't seen Helena hide it before. So that may be interesting. But if it happens again with Cosima and Shay, I'm not really sure. But can you sort of walk me through what happened with that final Delphine and Shay scene? Specifically, what did Delphine tell Shay to tell Cosima?
She says, basically all I have is she says it to tell Cosima. It's okay to tell Shay everything, and she gives her the business card, and then Cosima's clone number is written on it. So that, you know, that business card is definitely something that came from Delphine, because nobody else would have any way of knowing that.
Okay, that's what I thought, but I just wanted to make sure, because the way she, I think at least for me, the way she framed the idea was very much like, wait, so you want Shay to tell Cosima that Delphine told her everything, or do you want Cosima to tell you? I was just very confused about it.
Well, I think Delphine realizes that it's Cosima's secret to tell.
Yeah,
that she can't go like inducting people into the Clone Club. She needs to give her blessing. And I think also at this point, I think Delphine was pretty aware that she was not long for the world.
Yeah,
and
considering so, that Dr. Nealon said you won't live until morning.
Yeah, I think she took that very seriously. And of course, the second we see her in the parking garage alone, you know she's toast.
Well, even she did when she just stopped and turned around. It reminded me, spoiler alert for The Wire, there is a character in the season four finale who just decides, like, he knows he's going to go, but he's been kind of under the thumb of this other drug dealer for the entire past two seasons. So he decides to just sort of have a last stand, and he, instead of running away, he just sort of opens his chest up and gets shot. So it sort of reminds me of that with Delphine. Like, she's been running away, and has, as much as Ferdinand says he's been under her boot, she's been under the boot of a lot of people the past two seasons. And I would say that, sort of like Paul a few episodes ago, I feel like Delphine had her sort of redeeming episode here, both with her kind of making her last amends with Cosima and with Shay, and finally, you know, killing Nealon and finding out everything about the Neolutionists, and then for her to say, I'm done, time for me to go.
Yeah, she got a little bit of a farewell, so.
Yeah, which is good, and I have to say, one of the things Orphan Black does really well is that when they do kill off main characters like her or Paul, they really do set him up in a fanfare. Even characters like Paul that were not as well received, and even Delphine, I at least did not receive her too well the outside of season one. They at least send them up in a grand finale.
Yeah, it's almost like they're paying tribute to the actors more than the characters. It's like both of those actors, I think, did a really amazing job with what they were given. And even if we didn't like them as characters, I think it's good to just kind of give them a good piece of final scenery to chew on before we send them off into the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and she also, I mean, we don't know who Cosima, who Delphine's shooter is, but she asked her, what did she ask her? You know, if what will happen to her? Are we assuming that she's asking about Cosima, or do you think she's asking about Rachel?
I think she's probably asking about Rachel, but I don't know for sure because I don't think she knows where exactly Rachel wound up.
Yeah, though we have to, I mean, I'm sure we'll look into her shooter's possible identity in the off season. We did hear heels, sort of like Delphine's heels, so I'm wondering if it was a woman who was the shooter.
Yeah, or maybe that's where Marion Bowles is.
Yeah, that's, I was possibly thinking that. So they bring her back to the series and she's sort of like the number two to Sarah Duncan. That could be a possibility.
Yeah, I think next season, we're just gearing up for the Neolutionists to be the big bads again.
Yeah. With the different set of characters, it seems like if it's under Sarah Duncan, it's a total different hierarchy than we just had Dr. Leakey and all of his monitors.
Yeah. Yeah. This is going to be a different dynamic, but it's interesting that they're able to bring that back again. It's sort of like how, you know, James Bond's main enemy for a couple of episodes, you know, he's got Goldfinger and he's got Thunderball, and we'll come back to Spectre, and then we'll go have a different enemy, and then we'll go back to Spectre again and keep going back to the same well.
Yeah, exactly. There's always going to be one, I guess, hub enemy to come back to. We just had a couple seasons where we sort of strayed away from that, but now we're back to our roots.
Yep. I guess the Prolethians are the Ernst Blofeld of the Orphan Black universe.
Was Ernst Blofeld not liked as well?
Nobody likes Ernst Blofeld, except maybe a little bit in On Your Majesty's Secret Service when he's played by Telly Savalas.
Okay, so then it's an apt comparison then. What are the casters?
The casters are like the freaky henchmen.
Who are the enemies in Quantum of Solace? I feel like those are the casters.
Oh, God. We're kind of pretending that one didn't happen.
Yeah, exactly. It's a total apt comparison. And then whatever, I'm only a modern Bond enthusiast. So whoever Javier Bardem's character was in Skyfall, I feel like that'll be hopefully what the next big bad is going to be.
Yeah, I could get behind that. But
where like everyone's like, oh, this is great.
If we want to take a little bit out of the Roger Moore Bond universe, if we want to bring somebody in to be Jaws, I'm totally cool with that too.
Can we? I mean, the Neolutionist, we might actually have a man who has shark teeth, so it all works out.
Good point. You know, they had a guy with a tail, so they could totally have somebody with Jaws teeth.
Yeah, and as you know, if their budgets are upped and they have more in their visual effects department, I could totally see freakier stuff happening in Austria next season.
Yeah, maybe they go through like this whole Jurassic Park thing and they've got like animal human hybrids that they have to fight.
And then we had revealed Sarah Duncan's brother, played by Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah. Incidentally, I got one more observation before we close the book on season 3. And that was, I really love the totally fan-wanky way we explain the way that Kendall Malone does not look exactly like a 65-year-old Tatiana Maslany.
Yes, absolutely. But I still, once Scott sort of explained this whole Chimera thing, I was sort of looking here saying like, well, so is she supposed to look like a combination of Tatiana Maslany and Ari Millen then?
Yeah, like if they had a baby and then that baby grew up to be an old lady.
And ate her twin in the womb?
Yeah, I don't know. I think she looks enough like them that it's plausible she's related to them. I think that's the only thing they were going for.
Yeah, which, I mean, I don't know how finicky you can be in terms of the, it's an original clone mythology that they're coming up with themselves. But it is, that was a little odd to me.
Yeah, I think the only way that they could plausibly have that be a living person is to, like, throw aging makeup on Ari Millen and Tatiana Maslany, and nobody's going to like that.
And have them talk at the same time?
Yeah.
To have, like, a male-female voice. One more little observation I'll make about the episode. Badass Felix kicking in the door.
And I love that he goes right back to the Felix we know and love, and he's like, I didn't think that was going to work.
Yeah, and I will say just generally, I think we had some things we grabbed about in the first half of the season. One of the things I'm happy we got in the second half of the season was more Felix stuff between, you know, his, obviously he did the farce stuff with Allison like he always does, but even that scene that he had in the nail salon with Crystal, where he sort of had some sympathy that we didn't expect him to. And even little moments like this, I hope we get more of those types of things next season.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also wanted to note that I watched this episode at 7 o'clock this morning, so I was a little groggy and I did not think to look for this, but Dalton Ross has a cameo in the finale.
Yes, he plays a voter named Denton, and it's in the scene when Allison's stopping at the polling place, and he has this one line where he's like, I think you can win. And he's in like three shots of the whole thing, but I was super excited about that, and good on you, Dalton Ross.
Yeah, the way he's been talking about it on Instagram, you can tell he's a genuine fan of the show.
Yeah, which is great. I do feel like as much as the series has caught on, I feel like there is not a lot of Orphan Black representation on the media in both coverage in terms of like articles. I know it's covered on EW and AV Club, but in a little bit on previously.tv, but I can't find any or other major places. And even on podcasts, we're happy to be one of the few Orphan Black podcasts out there. But So good for him to, you know, a pretty big entertainment writer to be able to not only declare his love for the show, but be able to get written on as a role.
Yeah. I mean, Mike, you and I got to work on that. Like, maybe we can.
I know.
Maybe we can get written in as, like, additional clones next season.
Yes. Mick and Gemma.
Yeah. We can have. Yeah, we could be extra clones. We can be clones of ourselves. We're not picky.
Yeah, we'll work in the police station.
Yeah. I mean, I'll go, you know, take minutes at the school trustee meetings.
Yeah, exactly. Just put us in. Shameless plug here. Put it. I know you guys are listening. Find a reason to do so, because we do love this show.
I will pay my own airfare to Toronto.
I will pay my own horse fare to Toronto.
Put me in, coach. I'm ready to play.
Literally, put me in coach on the airplane. I'm fine.
Yeah, totally. Put me in steerage. Don't even care.
Put me in with the dogs.
Yeah. All right. So we briefly touched on what our hashtag has got to be for this finale of the season.
Yes.
I think we got to go with hashtag Mountiesage, which is MountieSsage.
Yes. Unfortunately, the very last Canadian reference we will make this season of Orphan Black.
Yeah, we got a whole year to think up more things about Canada, and I'm actually, between now and then, I'm going to be in Canada at least once, so I will keep my eyes open for more things we can make fun of.
Amazing.
Yeah, this is the extent I go to for the sake of this podcast. So we got plenty of really cool things going on in the post-show recaps universe. We are wrapping up Orange is the New Black coverage, and Mike is spearheading a rewatch of The Wire.
Yes, which will be starting soon, hopefully. Still trying to work out the kinks on that, but hopefully that will happen soon, which, you know, even me making references on it here makes me really excited to rewatch it. So hopefully you guys that are fans of The Wire can join us in on that.
Yeah, and if there's other shows you want to check out this summer, chances are we're going to be covering them for post-show recaps. Just pop on over to the site and see what tickles your fancy. Feel free to leave us comments on that page, or you can tweet at us. My Twitter handle is HaymakerHattie.
And mine is at a Mike Bloom type. And I guess we'll do some quick plugs here for other stuff that's going on Rob Has a Website. I know you can find us both on the reality TV feed on Rob Has a Podcast and reality TV wrap ups later on this summer. I'm going to be coming back at some point. We're still trying to figure out the kinks behind it, but I'm definitely will be back at some point to cover the newest season of Last Comic Standing. And Jess, what will you be doing with reality TV this summer?
Well, Mike, you may be done with the Canada references, but I assure you,
you're
my friend,
started.
I'm just getting started, as we say here on Post Show Recaps. I'm going to be covering Amazing Race Canada with Dan Heaton all summer long, and that starts up on July 8th. We're about to drop a cast preview sometime next week or the week after, and there will be so much fun with Amazing Race Canada. So many subtle digs at our neighbors to the north, and so much love for everybody in the great nation of Canada. And that's going to be starting up very, very soon.
And speaking of so much love, I just want to take some time on air just to say thank you for jumping onto this and you know, asking me to do this. I know when you came to me last fall and asked about Orphan Black, I'd heard about the show before, but I never dove into it. And so I thank you for kind of giving me that push into the pool of diving into this really fun show and taking 10 weeks to just sit down and go on weird tangents and talk about all the fun stuff that happened with the season. Though this may be considered to be one of the weaker seasons of the show, I think this was a lot of fun to cover.
Yeah. And thank you, Mike, for jumping in and, like, picking the show up just because I told you to.
I'm very impressionable like that.
I could not have done it without your, you know, plasticity-ridden brain.
Anytime. And also, thank you to those of you guys that listened out there the entire season and, you know, tweeted us hashtags and some of you have gotten into conversations with us about it on Twitter. A lot of you, the listeners that like to, you know, that helpfully pointed out to us that Agricola was actually a game. We love you guys, and we wouldn't be here without you guys. So we hope you guys can join us in season 4 in about a year or so.
Yeah. And anytime you guys make it up to the greater Metro New York area, Mike and I will totally sit down and play Agricola with you.
Yeah. With some babka cake.
Totally. All right, guys. So thank you so much for bearing with us all season. And we will see you next year for more Orphan Black, I hope. And in the meantime, tune in, catch us everywhere else. And we hope you have a great summer.